Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is the GNE Navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of the morning, August 5th, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 80, and the title is The Suspense of the Stall. It's been quite a week for me, or however many days have passed since the last briefing, and some momentous things have been happening, which I dearly wish to report to you if I can only remember what they are. Typically, well, let me put it this way, my friends. Whether you're GNE crew members, whether you've done the Gaian Tantric Vow, and you are in the practice of PT, or whether you're just others who happen to pick up on these talks, there's a negotiation of power going on here between the Nav and whoever listens to the Nav. So I'm not just talking, I'm transmitting. And these negotiations of power, these transactions of power, to use a more correct term, belong to this moment in the history of our species. They are transactions that can only specifically occur right now in the conditions of the 3 years, from March 2011 to March 2014. Some of you will know that on the planetaries in the Planetary Tantra section of metahistory.org, there is an introductory page. Let me see if I can find it. Let me point out that anyone who uses a search engine such as Google and puts in Planetary Tantra finds that this introduction page comes up at the top of the entries. Supposedly, there are 439,000 results. There are ways in which you can get yourself on Google, and there are ways to get your company or your business or your name or whatever into the search engines so that you are prioritized, as you all know. I sometimes receive emails from people proposing to do this for me. Well, I haven't done one single thing to get Planetary Tantra at not only at the first entry, but all of the first entries. All of the first entries, the first five or six entries, and then many more to follow, go directly to the Planetary Tantra section of metahistory.org. And I haven't done a thing to make that happen. It happens because the material is original and it can't be found anywhere else. There's only one place where you find Planetary Tantra and the Sophianic Vision story, and that is on metahistory.org and gaiaspora.org. Part of the power of what I'm teaching as I learn it is due to the raw feed. This entire teaching, this instruction for the GNE comes on a raw feed out of the enlightened mind of the human animal. And that is your mind as well as my mind, because there is only one mind. I have your mind. You have my mind. When you see how I handle my intelligence, make the distinction between intelligence and mind. I appear to handle our mind differently than you would. Perhaps you think I handle it better more skillfully. It's the same mind. What's different is that my intelligence is trained so that I can handle the mind, that my intelligence is an instrument for the one mind, and so is yours. So the raw transmission comes from the one mind, which is, of course, the mind of the wisdom goddess herself. Then it comes through the Anthropos, depending on the savvy and sophistication of the human animal who is transmitting it. It's as simple as that. I have a lot more to say about this, I think, in the near future. I've been reflecting a lot upon the question of articulation of the goddess wisdom by human animals. I've been reflecting a lot on that during this shift. We're now in the 28th day of the Vajrayogini shift of 2013. So, to return to my point, the first entry that comes up in Google is Introducing Planetary Tantra. You click on that, and then it says, what is planetary tantra? Rapturous immersion through desire and imagination in the dreaming power of the earth. It is the most intimate way of bonding with the planetary animal mother, Gaia. And then it goes on to describe some of the aspects of planetary tantra, one of which is the love of power, but not in the vulgar sense, that is to say, having power over others. No. As the introduction says, the love for pleasure is a cosmic impulse so vast and consuming that it would wreak havoc if not balanced with another impulse, the love of handling power. Not the love of power, but of handling it. Tantra is a way of handling power, especially the power of attraction, mood, mania, inspiration, including any emotion, positive or negative. And finally, that little essay goes on to point out that although planetary tantra, and there's a beautiful illustration there of a tantrika, Hindu tantrika woman being presented offerings by a king and by a lady in a colored shawl. It goes on to say that although there is no precedent for planetary tantra and that it must stand on its originality, nevertheless, there is an ancient tradition called Shaktism, which is translated by scholars as the worship of power. Shaktism. And so planetary tantra is a form of Shaktism. Now, when it comes to power, I'm getting around to my point here, because I've been spinning like a top for about 5 days, I think, 5 or 6 days. When it comes to power, you always want to think about instrument. Now, you know that intelligence in Greek is nous. So that's a direct translation of the Greek word nous, but the Greek word nous also means something like spirit. You know, it translates as the spiritual factor. What is the spiritual factor of the human animal? Well, it is in part your intelligence, in part your imagination, and in part your emotion. Those three combine into what might be called the spiritual germ of the Anthropos creature. Now, intelligence is not the primordial mind of the Aeon Sophia. The primordial mind of the Aeon Sophia is an aeonic intelligence, yes, but it is also a mind being that of an aeon, which is far beyond the scope of any human mind. So how then does the mind and intelligence of a human animal interface with her power, her intelligence, and mind in the ultimate sense, that is to say, cosmic mind? How does that interface occur? It occurs through what is called in Sanskrit, upaya, or instrumentality. Upadana is another word. It means there has to be an instrumentality. There has to be a vehicle for that interface to become real. Now, your intelligence is not separate from your body, nor is it separate from your emotions. So, you have a threefold instrument. Your emotional capacity, which is a vast range of positive and negative feelings, it includes empathy, it includes hatred. Your body itself, which is a miracle of alchemical, physiochemical, and psychochemical elixirs dissolved in water, along with some carbon elements. And then your intelligence. What is your intelligence? It is what you have learned, what you are able to learn. Down at Ambergane House, where I have my library, most of the books are out now on shelves in different sections of the house, it's actually like walking around in a standing display of the intelligence of John Lash. That is to say, not I didn't get all my intelligence out of those books, but the books show how I trained my instrument, how I trained and honed the instrument of my intelligence. You want to think of yourself as a Stradivarius violin. The body or the wood of the violin is your physical body, which has been beautifully tempered. The strings of the violin are your intelligence, and the tonality or sound that the violin produces is your emotion. You're like a Stradivarius violin, and so am I. And my instrument plays in one way due to the way my instrument has been trained. So the largest section of books in the Ambergane Library right now is, guess what? Literature, poetry, poetics, and romanticism. And so my intelligence has been trained in various ways, but unevenly. There is diversity in the training of your intelligence. There ought to be. There is great joy in that diversity. So I've had some training in Goethean science. I've had some training in Chinese philosophy, in Taoism. You know, I've had some training, obviously, in Gnosticism. I've had massive training in astrology and astronomy. You know, I've had very little training in horticulture. I have not had training in music, in how to play music or read music or understand musical composition. I have had some training in history, but it's very spotty, mostly ancient history. I have, for instance, had no training in American history, such as the history of the Civil War. By training, you can say learning training, you know. Your learning process, your desire to learn, trains and hones your instrument. And depending on how your instrument is honed, you translate and transmit the raw drive in your particular way. So all of us draw from an original source. Planetary Tantra comes from an original source, which is the same source upon which the Teleste drew for this intel. The Gnostic intel comes from one source. It is the paramount and unique source on this planet because the source is the planet itself. Nothing is comparable to this. We all draw on the same source. Originality has one source. And of course, the originator is the source of all originalities, right? All singularities. And add to it, the beauteous part is that every single human animal can develop an original style depending on what you have learned and cultivated in the training of your instrument. So my style depends largely upon a mastery of language itself. Language is my mistress. And the deepest impact of the training that I have done in my life, the learning and self-learning, has been in literature, romanticism, poetry, and poetics. And there's a massive amount of books in that area. And so you can infer from the style and delivery of an individual person how they have trained their instrument. And all kinds of training are valid. All kinds are valid. In fact, this revelation of the mind of the wisdom goddess, the living intelligence of the earth, interfaced with human intelligence, is so vast and diverse that it can be expressed through a countless number of instrumentalities and a countless number of trained intelligences. And that is what the mysteries were about, of course. The mysteries were about producing that diversity of learning and sending it out into the world. Hence, the leaders of the mysteries were the teachers and educators of the ancient races of Europe prior to the rise of Christianity. Now, having said all that, which I never intended to say when I opened this talk, let me get to the point about power. What we are doing in the GNA is exceptionally powerful, and it's becoming more powerful. Now, I can tell you that when I do a NAB briefing, such as Mama Teach Manners or the previous one, particularly the eretic proposition, the power of what comes through the instructions that I translate into that briefing knocks me for a loop. So if you are feeling power on your end, because you're in the raw feed with me, that's why you're feeling this power. You're in the raw feed with me. You know, there's a great, great saying. It's one of my favorite sayings of all time. And I used to quote it extensively. I came across it probably when I was 19 years old in the writings of the Chinese mystic Chuang Tzu. Chuang Tzu is largely known for his saying one time he didn't know if he was a butterfly dreaming he was a man or a man dreaming he was a butterfly. Anyway, I used to steep myself deeply in the writings of these Chinese mystics. And as you know, I was deeply influenced in my 20s by Chan Buddhism and by the 10th century Chan masters, such as Huang Po. And that has a lot to do with my training my instrument for what I can now do in the GNE and what I can also do as a Tertan and a Nahual as well. Anyway, I used to quote this saying from Chuang Tzu, the Tao can be transmitted, but it cannot be received. Now, this is an amazing statement. The Tao can be transmitted, but it cannot be received. You know, to be proper and to be correct, one should not even comment on this saying. But I'm going to go a little bit off form and just make one comment. Cannot be received because the transmission that reaches you reaches the transmission in you. Therefore, when you receive what I say, you're not receiving anything. What you're receiving is the style. You're receiving my style. But what you receive in that style is the same as you transmit yourself through your own style, whatever that style may be. There is room for everybody in every type of discipline in Planetary Tantra, but there is just one fundamental rule. Stay in the story and do not embellish recklessly and narcissistically with the fantastic imagination. The story itself is a product of the true imagination of the human species. And when you stay in the narrative rigorously, because it is a pleasure to do so, just like it is a pleasure downhill skiing to stay on your feet, just like it is a pleasure sailing or sailboarding to stay in the wind, to stay at the crest of that wave. You stay there. You stay there like that in this story. And your capacity for expression of the true imagination grows even sharper and stronger. So there's a lot of power in the GNE and Planetary Tantra. And to make my point here, finally, I'm getting around to it. There are moments when I do a NAV briefing and I get totally knocked out by what I've said. And that happened with the eretic proposition. I basically folded after that talk. So that was, I guess, 78. And then Mama Teach Manners was 79. Is that correct? And when did I do the eretic proposition? It looks like I did it sometime. I can't even tell when. About a week ago, say. Well, let me give you a little update on what's been going on over the past week. First of all, bear in mind that it was exactly a week ago that I did the eretic proposition. And that transmission was so powerful that I was thrown into an altered state. And while I can function normally, more or less, I mean, you know, it's hard to describe. It's not exhaustion. It's just like I've been turned inside out. That's the best way I can put it. There's a feeling that I have been absolutely turned inside out. So I felt that way for the last week, due in some measure to having delivered that NAV briefing, but equally so due to something else. I would have you recall that this is still currently the period between the 21st of July, which is the anniversary of the Rhonda moment, and the 8th of August, which will be the 5th anniversary of the day that I received the term of Gaia Awakening. Okay, so this 18-day period. What is happening in this 18-day period is unprecedented. First of all, even before the 21st, I would say going on 2 weeks now easily, something is happening in the weather here that I cannot understand. I am, to use an expression, an interesting expression, nonplussed. I am nonplussed by the weather. For 2 weeks now, with the exception of about a day and a half, I get up and I go outside and the sky is entirely clear. There is not a cloud anywhere and there is no sign of an airplane anywhere through any hour of the day or night. And it's been going on like this for days. And the suspense has been building up, particularly over the last 5 or 6 days. I'm asking myself, where does this suspense come from? I'm living in a terrific sense of suspense. It seems to be derived from several factors. It's complex. First of all, it seems to be derived from that tremendous moment of July 7th, 2013, when the Aeon Sophia coordinated her first and second detention for the first time and broke through into the human mind in some manner which has yet to be realized and revealed. At the moment that that happened, and that Monday I did the Coast to Coast talk, and I was still up in Belgium, and from that moment on, there has been some kind of enormous momentum taking place in this sense that I have, and others as well, others among you and the crew writing me, telling me the same thing. Everything feels in some way different. There's a difference in the air. There's a palpable difference. And I'm seeing that difference unfold in a number of aspects. So that's one of them. The other one is that I'm having this extraordinary weather. And then I had those two vulture omens, vulture auguries. And since then, I've had two more bird auguries, which were totally astonishing. And all of this is happening here in Spain, here in Andalusia, in the Serranía de Ronda Mountains, looking out toward the coast of Africa. All this is happening under the inverted bowl of a sky that has some inexplicable property. I think this is the best way that I could put it. How subjective is this experiment? What is this inexplicable property of the sky mind? The sky mind, because the sky is a revelation of her mind. There is something in the sky. There is something happening. I don't know what it is. So this is creating a tremendous sense of suspense. And I have one other human animal to confirm these impressions with, by the way. So I occasionally see Kundry, or she comes up here, and we talk about this, and we look at the sky, and we look for airplanes, and we don't see any. I mean, none. This is the height of tourist season in Spain. For years, I am used to sitting on my terrace and looking to the south-southeast around 8:30 in the evening and seeing two flights come out of over the Atlantic, probably from Tenerife, the Azores, or the Canary Islands, toward Madrid and Malaga. No flights. Now, I haven't gone to the Malaga airport site and checked flights to see what flights of the 40 flights an hour that come in and out of Malaga, to see what flights would conceivably be flying over this area. I haven't done that. I've been tempted to do that, but I haven't done that. And the one reason why I haven't done that, get this, is because I don't want doing that to cause me to see flights. How subjective is this experiment? So anyway, there's another element of suspense. It's like I get up, I walk out, it's like, holy moly, the sky is exactly the same again. It's like the sky is like, it's like a glass bowl that has an opaque frosting on it that gets bluer as you go toward the dome, and it just sits there. And when am I going to see an airplane? You know? In fact, to be precise, I have seen two airplanes in the last 2 weeks. Two. One of them, I think I saw last Thursday at 8:43 in the evening. And it was flying along the coast, probably from Malaga to Casablanca. It was just a tiny little silver dart of a jet plane with a very, very short contrail. Then, on Friday, Friday evening, Quincy made some dinner and she brought it up to me because I'm not able to feed myself in this condition. And after we ate a bit, we sat on the terrace. And there was no planes. But we were thinking about planes. And so this is what happened. It was around 9 o'clock. The sky was perfectly clear. And at that time of the evening, birds come out. Sometimes bee eaters, which make a particular sound. Flocks of birds fly around kind of chaotically over the oak trees and down the hillside off to the right or on the other hillside up to the left. And sometimes swallows. For instance, at this hour in the local white village in that town, there are swallows flying over the roofs of the village. So if you're in town having a tapa at some terrace, you can watch the swallows flying around in the way that they do in the evening, you know, quite low and swooping down and flying in this excited and very unpredictable manner, as swallows will do. So I was sitting there, and suddenly I'm saying, oh, there's the bee eaters. We heard the bee eaters. Okay, there's a few bee eaters over there. Then it's like the bee eaters go, and there are some swallows. And I say, no more than 10. 8 or 10 swallows, just flying around, you know, in a little group, sort of off to the right, not above the house. We're sitting there looking at the sky, and all of a sudden, Kunji says, look, and I look up, and at a 45-degree angle, there's something in the sky. It looks like a silver pen. It looks like a cylinder. I can't see any wings on it. And it's flying directly over my house from right to left, from west to east. Now, it's extremely rare, and Kundry remarked this because she knows, for any airplane ever to fly directly over this house. They fly to the right and left or toward the south, or I can look north and see them, but they don't. There's no direct overflight. This is a direct overflight right to left as we're sitting on the terrace, and the terrace is aligned exactly right to left relative to the horizon, that is to say west to east. So I watch this plane go over. I say, does it have wings on it? She says, yeah, I can see wings. I could hardly see any wings. It just looked like a silver missile. So then it goes, and then we're sitting there, and then the swallows come around. And we move out on the terrace, so we're not sitting under the awning, sitting right under the sky. And I say to Kundry, gee, you know, I just had this thought. What if she brings back all the birds and all the insects, and all the bees, what if they just start coming back massively? What if they just reemerge? And I said to her, I don't know why I'm thinking that. It's just a thought that just drifted through my mind. And as I'm saying that, the swallows start to fly around above us. And we're both sitting there looking up from these lounge chairs, and we're looking up at the birds. And at first there's about, I don't know, it's hard to count them when they're flying, but there weren't many. It was the usual appearance of swallows in the evening. There are maybe a dozen or 20, but certainly not more than that. And they fly around erratically for a while, and then they go off somewhere. We're sitting there looking up, and I'm saying to her, hey, look at these birds. Look at the swallows. They're flying over us right now, and some of them are swooping down very low over our heads. We proceed to look at the swallows for half an hour, and this is what happens. I look up at the swallows. I see them against the background of the clear sky, and then something happens as if you're looking at a film and the frame jumps. A couple of frames jump. So there's a break in continuity And the frame jumps, and suddenly there are 30 swallows. And they fly around really chaotically over our heads, and just looking at them, and I just get time to marvel at how many there are, and the frame jumps again, and then there's 50. And it happened over and over again. And in the course of about 15 minutes, we're sitting there looking up at the sky, and there's 150, 200 swallows zooming around all over, directly over the house, and swooping down to within 10 feet of the terrace. And Kundry, who was sitting there, observed the same thing. In fact, at the moment it was happening, she remarks to me, well, where are these birds coming from? Doesn't it look to you like there's a multiplication of birds right in front of your eyes? Because other birds were joining the flock of swallows. But I couldn't detect where these other birds were coming from. They just seemed to come out of nowhere. So this happened on Friday night. And we were flabbergasted and totally floored. So then the next day, Saturday, was the day of the apogee surge. Remember, the apogee is perfectly stalled at 2 degrees of Cancer in the feet of the twins and has been stalled there for almost 2 months. This was the last moment of the stall on Saturday. I couldn't stand up on my feet. I slept for 10 solid hours. I was incapable of staying conscious. I just passed out. And I told Kundry, I said, you know, for the last few days, that is to say, since I did the aretic proposition talk, I feel at moments like I'm going to pass out. I feel like I'm just going to faint. I'm just going to keel over and faint. I think that I'm pushing the envelope to the absolute limit that it can be pushed to still be in the tonal in a normal fashion. So I collapsed on Saturday. I slept all day, slept through the heat of the day. I woke up around 8 o'clock in the evening. I step outside, I walk upon the terrace. What do I see? First of all, I see this one vulture. Every day now, when I get up and I walk outside, I see this one vulture. This one vulture has been hanging around for days now. And I watch it for a while, and then it kind of glides off to the east or glides off to the west. But it's as if I have to see this vulture the first thing that I get up. So I woke up Saturday, early in the evening. I look out, and there's a vulture up there. And guess what? I've never seen this before. The vulture is spiraling in a thermal. And guess what's spiraling with it? A whole flock of sparrows. What is the vulture doing flying with sparrows? So this lasts for just a few minutes, and the vulture planes away and planes off in its elegant fashion off into the distance. And then the flock of sparrows comes and starts to fly over my terrace. So I sit down on the lounge chair and I look up. And it did exactly the same thing it did on the Friday evening. This time I'm alone. There's a multiplication of sparrows right in front of my eyes. And so I'm totally floored. I'm in a state of complete bafflement about the absence of airplanes. The total absence of clouds in the sky is very mysterious. In fact, there was one day when there were some clouds, but by the end of the day, it cleared, and it was once again cloudless. There were 2 days, in fact, when there were some clouds, I would say in a 16-day period, There were only 2 days when there were some clouds, but they didn't last long, and it wasn't an overcast layer. It was just random clouds here and there, and eventually they were swept away. So I'm living in the midst of all this. I'm living in the suspense of the stall. I'm living in the 18 days until the anniversary of the term of Gaia awakening. And it's just about all I can handle to just walk around on 2 feet. Now, I just caught that I was saying sparrows, okay? Did I say sparrows all along? I can't remember. Or did I say swallows, which is correct, and then switch to sparrows? In any case, I must correct what I just said. Of course, it was not a vast and strangely multiplying congregation of sparrows. It was swallows. And at the moment I was watching it with Kundry, she said to me, well, could be that the sparrows are the happiness that you talked about. I think the two recent talks are the first time, represent the first time in the GNE that I've talked about happiness. Remember the proposition of happiness? Success for this experiment on her terms happens with the shared happiness of all the subjects of the experiment. It's set up that way. It's set up to succeed in the happiness of all the subjects. Well, as the two of us were sitting there on the terrace, talking softly about this phenomenon as it was happening, thoughts of happiness came to my mind. And also, I thought about this, my friends, looking at the multiplication of swallows who fly with a rampant happiness, a frenzy of happiness, and the freedom and delight of children running around crazily on a playground. Contemplating the sparrows and talking softly, I said, look, maybe this is interactivity. Maybe this is the beginning of how she shows that she knows that we know what she's doing. Maybe it begins with bird omens and omens in the sky and changes in the sky. You know, on any given day, I have difficulty answering my email. I read all of your emails and I value them. I truly do. On any given day, I have difficulty reading the emails simply because I don't have the patience, difficulty responding to them, excuse me. Simply because I don't have the patience. It's not as if I don't have the time. I just don't have the patience. You know, the internet and the computer is too slow for me. It's very exasperating because when I have to type and click and scroll and drag a mouse around, it's exasperatingly slow. And when I click, even if the result of the click is instantaneous, it's too slow for me because I'm traveling at a ferocious velocity. And particularly lately, considering what I'm undergoing, it's impossible for me to get back to you. But a number of crew members have written beautiful and lengthy descriptions of similar experiences, particularly with birds. Bird omens seem to be prominent at this time. Something else that comes as a concurrence and confirmation from the crew mail is the observation of the silence and the serenity. There is a palpable serenity in the air. The silence has a quality of something like a higher dimension of tranquility. How subjective is this experiment? I mean, what is this feeling? Is this the beginning of our breakthrough empathically to her? A breakthrough in which human animals can feel what she feels at the moments when we know what she's doing. That's what interactivity really is. It goes beyond just having a description of what she's doing or what she might do into the direct perception of what she's doing. And to have her reach us in some way through the natural world. I'm wondering if this is what's happening. A number of you have noted in different parts of the world, far removed from here, the property of the sky has changed, and there is a deep, abiding, resonating serenity coming out of the earth itself. So I don't know. There's a lot happening. And this now briefing is just my way of catching up with myself, as it were, and letting you know what's going on with me before I return to the theme of the eretic proposition. So to conclude this briefing, let me cover a few points that I have written down here in notes for the first week of August. Over the last few days, I've been reflecting on the subject matter of ruthless caring. I made a choice to dedicate a NAV briefing to that material, as you know. That material was a subject of a seminar I did about 30 years ago. As I explained it, it shows the conversions of the Tibetan Wheel of Life with its schema of the three poisons at the center, the six realms, and then the surrounding circle of the 12 links in the chain of interdependent origination into astrological terms. With that conversion, you can place yourself in various realms. For instance, I'm in the Titan realm. If you're an Aries, a Libra, you're in the Demon realm. If you're a Cancer Capricorn, you're in the Hungry Ghost realm. And none of these realms are preferable to any others. They're just metaphors for behavioral syndromes. And so that was the subject of the NAV briefing entitled Mama Teach Manners. I have to say that I am wondering if it was a mistake to give you that material. I more or less tend to think so. And so I just want you to know that I have not regrets, but I have some reservations about giving you that material simply because it's probably superfluous and not helpful. You already have an enormous amount of homework to do to keep up with the GNE. And I don't think that ruthless caring material on the syndromes of behavior of the astrological signs is particularly pertinent right now, honestly. So I would say that I had a failure of judgment in making that into a NAB briefing. You may disagree, you may like the material or find it catchy or find it that it generates some insight or other. But of course, I'm not able to give it to you adequately, put it in your hands as in a user-friendly form so you can actually look at it and work with it. And I'm not going to do that because I think it's too much and I think it's a distraction. And I want you to know that you're really not missing anything if you don't have that material in your homework pile. Remember, the call sign for Tantra Mother is VJY651. The six referring to the six realm teaching. The five referring to the five skull crown instruction. And the one referring to the supreme teaching of Tantra Mother, which is release from pretending. So I got all that. It came in a massive flash, and I wished to share as much of it as I could. But I am under the rule of discipline in this practice as much as you are. The rule requires us to be rigorous and not overload the practice with extraneous material. So I have to conclude that that was somewhat extraneous. Another reflection regarding that last briefing, Mama Teach Manners. Whatever the relevance today of the ruthless caring material from that seminar, who knows, one of you could take it up and revive it and upgrade it and make it relevant and make it current and make it useful. I'm not precluding that possibility. But whatever the relevance of that material, it is, in my mind, second to the other two aspects of her teaching. Everyone in Planetary Tantra must understand release from pretending. The behaviors of pretending permeate our world and create enslavement. Tantra Mother liberates her children from the enslavements of pretending. So that is tremendously important. But equally so is the teaching of the five skull crown. As a matter of fact, I would say that that is by far the outstanding teaching that comes from Mama Teach to be applied in the immediate future. How would I compare the instruction of the five skull crown initiation to the instruction on the six realms? This is an important question. So listen closely, and I'll see if I can make it cogent. I said regarding the teaching of the six realms, which is the conversion of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, that it provides the syntax and the cueing to detect immediately the kinds of behavior that you're facing in correction and non-correction scenarios. It is there's a metaphor here probably somewhere that I can't pull out of my mind. It is like it's a fast-track system to the perception of human behavior in such a way that you liberate yourself from the entrapments of that behavior. You liberate not only yourself, but you liberate yourself from the entrapments that come from those who are enacting those forms of behavior. So when you can read the games, it's like games people play. It's like that. It's the tantric equivalent of games people play. You might remember, well, some of you are too young for this, but in the 60s there was a big fad over a book by Eric Byrne called Games People Play. Go look it up. It was an extremely vivid and user-friendly system for detecting behaviors, particularly social behaviors. And I believe that the term attached to the games people play agenda was transactional psychology. That's a term from the mid or late 60s. Transactional psychology concerns what? Let me go see. I'm curious. Okay, here it is. Transactional analysis, developed by Eric Berne, B-E-R-N-E. Transactional analysis is one of the most accessible theories of modern psychology. TA, as it's called, was founded by Eric Berne, and the famous parent-adult-child theory is still being developed today. TA has wide applications in clinical, therapeutic, organizational, blah, 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 blah. Okay. When you're in business, a parent, a social worker, or interested in personal development, Eric Berne's transactional analysis theories and those of his followers will enrich your dealings with people and your understanding of yourself. And so this is the field of transactional psychology. And the teaching of the 12 realms, Mama Teach Manners, is a tantric form of shorthand of transactional analysis of human behaviors. And in that respect, it's viable. It's viable. It's workable. It's not relevant or pertinent to us now. You can set it aside. You can put it, you can file it away if you are so inclined. If you find it catchy and helpful and pertinent to say, I'm in that game, I'm playing the demon game, I'm playing the animal game, or someone else is playing the God game, and you read that game, and therefore you free up your interaction with that person through reading the game, well, go ahead, that's fine if it works. I can't provide much by way of supplementary instruction in that area for obvious reasons, because I'm totally overwhelmed with what I'm handling right now. But to move on to the five element in the 651 call sign. Why is the five skull crown initiation more pertinent to the GNE? And why is it a more powerful instrument of transactional perception than the six realm system? Good question. This is the basic theory of the five skull crown instruction. The Dakinis of the Shakti cluster and the wrathful and dangerous guardians of traditional Tibetan Tantra wear a crown or diadem of five skulls. Now, there is a particular way to picture this diadem. Imagine that you are standing face to face in front of Vajrayogini. Her face is at the level of your face. She's red. And she is wearing this diadem. Now, look up at her forehead and look at the diadem of skulls. Let me tell you what you see. First, you see centrally a large skull, and on either side of that, two other skulls. So, there is one skull at the center of the forehead that is larger than the others. Directly to the right and left of that are two smaller skulls, and then again, to the right and left, are two smaller skulls. So, what you have is two skulls of a small size on the outside of the diadem, the right and left, two skulls of a medium size, and the central skull, which is larger than the other four. It's really important to picture the proportions of these skulls. What these skulls represent is absolutely brilliant. They represent a metaphor that applies in a literal way to the human mind. Why? Because they refer to the brain. Because what is inside the skull? The skull is a container of the brain. But when you have the skull, the brain is gone. Because the brain is rather like soft tissue. It's like a wet Kleenex. That's the actual consistency of the live brain. The brain extracted from a corpse hardens, and it has the appearance and feeling of a cauliflower, although it's softer than cauliflower. But it appears to be something solid that you could hold in your hands. But if you reached into your skull right now for your brain, or my brain, good luck, you would not be able to grasp it because it would run through your hands like saturated Kleenex. And so what is this content that is inside the skull cup, the skull cap? Well, it is the elixir of the brain. And what is the elixir of the brain? Well, we know now, quite recently in scientific terms, that the brain operates by the discharge across the synapses of upwards of 20 neurotransmitting chemicals. These are the elixirs of the brain. So not only is the brain an electrified tissue with electrical impulses charging and discharging constantly in the billions from axon to dendron, but there is a physical, physiochemical, neurochemical exchange as well, and that is the operation of the cerebral elixirs. The Dakinis operate upon these cerebral elixirs, and they are actually able to transform these elixirs and to optimize the performance of the neurotransmitting exchanges in your brain. When you are in a state of Dakini instruction, or when you're in a state of cognitive illumination, such as I was in at the Rhonda moment, what happens in your brain is something like a tsunami of surf. Normally, what you have in your brain is a light surf. This light surf is the actual neurochemical charging and discharging across the synaptic gaps in your brain. It is a chemical discharging from axon to dendron. And normally, it is like a slow, easy seething, as if you were sitting at the beach somewhere on a calm day, and there's the entire ocean in front of you, but the ocean is relatively calm, and so the ocean laps up on the beach, and it seethes gently, and it leaves a light layer of foam, of creamy foam, as it withdraws, and then it comes again and laps up on the beach. That is your normal neurochemical discharge across the synapses. When you're in a state of cognitive illumination, it's like tsunami wave across your synapses. It's a rush of monumental proportions. And so there is a physiochemical, cerebrochemical correspondence to samadhi and cosmic consciousness, as well as to Dakini instruction. Now, it is known, if you listen to Bruce Lipton, or if you listen to the people who are talking about epigenetics and about the chemical nature of emotions, it is known that every emotion has a chemical signature, and that the brain is constantly communicating with the body at the cellular level, and at the cellular level, the cells are also excreting through their pores chemicals, and there are chemical exchanges happening with every cell, which we experience as emotions. So it is now known that your whole field of emotions, as well as your cerebral cognition, is material. Don't forget one of the principles of Mayavada Vedanta. Everything is material. Emotions are chemical. Thoughts are chemical. The teaching, the traditional Tibetan teaching of the five skull crowns says that the Dakinis can transmute the five primary toxic chemical emotions experienced by the human animal into wisdom elixirs. How this is done is the instruction of the five skull crown, which comes directly from Mama Teach. Mama Teach transmutation. Mama Teach negative emotion change. Mama Teach five skull crown. What are these five negative emotions? Destructive emotions. If you go and research it in the traditional sources, you'll find quite a number of variations. I would say at least half a dozen, probably more. They name these five emotional toxins differently. I have been at great pains to find the correct language for these emotional toxins. You know that I've said that I never work anything out if I can avoid it, in the fashion of elaborating thought by a male mind process. The correlations of the Mahavidyas and the Diamond Sky Dakinis to the constellations in Planetary Tantra did not come about that way. I did not sit down and work out these correlations. You know, I am not like, what's his name? Like many male mind gurus. Yeah, Ken Wilber, you know, the Atman Project, the spectrum of consciousness, up from Eden, you know, the history of human evolution, the development of the levels of consciousness, and a transpersonal view of human consciousness. That's all a huge male mind construction. I don't go there. I don't operate in that way. Because I don't do that, I have not been able to arrive at a satisfactory designation of five specific terms for the five specific toxic or negative emotions to be transmuted in this instruction until just last week. Then it so happened that during the shift of Tantra Mother, I sat down with a piece of paper, and I just wrote them down. I didn't think them out. I just wrote them down. They came spontaneously, and I'm most satisfied to tell you that I have finally arrived at what I consider to be a workable syntax for this instruction. Look again at the face of the Dakini standing in front of you. Look at her red face. Look at her gleaming eyes. Look at her full juicy lips and her fangs. And then look at the five skull crown. The central crown, central part of the crown, the biggest skull, is envy. To the left, which is her right, go to the left now. The smaller skull on the left is pride. And the smaller one again on the left is fear. But understand that that is not the healthy instinct of fear. It is induced or conditioned fear. For instance, there's a difference between walking down a path in the Grand Canyon and having a certain fear when you come to a place where the path is disintegrating that you might fall. That kind of fear is healthy. The fear of someone you see in the parking lot of a shopping mall that you sense to be a predator who is lurking around, that fear is healthy. The fear of the skull, the small skull on the left, is induced fear. It's like the fear induced in humanity by the phony war on terror. So, induced fear, pride, envy, that is the central skull. Now go to the right. The skull immediately to the right is ingratitude. Ingratitude. Ingratitude is actually an emotion, an emotional stance or position, or an emotional response that is as real and autonomous as gratitude. Everyone knows what gratitude is. Well, ingratitude also exists. And that is a toxic emotion. Finally, the smaller skull, again, at the right side, at the limit of the crown, which is guilt. But again, this is guilt is an induced emotion. It's induced. So the two emotions at the smaller ones at each end of the diadem are fear and guilt. The two emotions that are directly contingent to envy are pride and ingratitude. And those are the five negative emotions. Now just imagine this. We've seen these insanely archontic virtual reality devices that science is pushing purely for economic reasons because it creates jobs and sells gimmicks, it sells gizmos, and also because the arrogance of science thinks that they can do better than the natural world provides. So you have you go out and you spend $8,500 on a virtual reality vacation package. And you come home with a CD, which you put in your computer, and then you put on your face these glasses that are like, you can't see through them, you just see into them. And you sit down with this band across your eyes and these earphones, and you push a button, and you go on vacation in Bermuda in virtual reality, right? You all know what I'm talking about. We are all living in a virtual reality generated by the five negative emotions. And the central one is envy. And the reason why that's central is because it is reinforced by the archons. Envy is the one emotion that the archons can feel. It's the only emotion that they have innately the capacity to feel. And envy, their envy, locks in very conveniently to the envy that human animals can feel. When you have on the virtual reality headset of the five poisons, you go around and you do not see the real world of humanity, the divine experiment as it really is. What you see is an archontic replication of that world in which all behaviors are driven by these five negative emotions, including your behavior, that of you who is wearing the headset. Now, what you do when you take the five crown, skull crown initiation, is you take that archonic headset, which is positioned in front of your eyes and directly over your ears, and you lift it up, and you put it on your forehead, and you wear it like a crown. And you take the two parts of it that go on your ears and you raise them off your ears and you put them on your temples and you wear it as a different device on your forehead. Just like Vajrayogini and other wrathful and protective deities wear the five skull crown on their heads. And when you wear it on your forehead, it immediately is transformed into a Flash Gordon type of device that allows you to detect envy, to detect pride, ingratitude, induced fear, and induced guilt, and blast those emotions immediately and convert them immediately into five different wisdom elixirs. So I'm using a kind of science fiction analogy here because I like it. I hadn't thought of it before. It just comes up. And it illustrates beautifully the power of heightened perception that comes from the five skull crown initiation. That power enables you to immediately and instantaneously transmute these negative emotions, not only in yourself, but wherever you encounter them with other people. That is how powerful this is. So I think you can see that even though the behavioral norms and syndromes comparable to transactional psychology would be very helpful, you know, in liberating social behavior, in liberating attitudes, the teaching of the five shema from Tantra Mother is more pertinent, more relevant, more urgent right now. That's why I'm giving you a little preview of the five skull crown instruction. And of course, this preview wouldn't be complete if I didn't provide a glimpse of the five wisdom elixirs that arise by transmutation of these five toxic emotions. The emotion of induced fear is transformed into delight. The emotion of pride, which carries the destructive sense of entitlement, which is a disaster wherever it arises in human relationships, is transformed into brutal honesty. Envy itself is transformed into vira, or the heroic quality of the human animal, which can be called intrepidity, to be intrepid, to be intrepid. Go investigate this word. What does it mean to be intrepid? Ingratitude is transformed into kindness, but a special kind of kindness. Kindness is innate to the human animal. But there is a kind of kindness that I would call furious kindness. It's the kindness that kills. And this is the transmutation of ingratitude. And finally, guilt. It's a little difficult to put a name on the quality or intensity of wisdom that arises by the transmutation of guilt. It's somewhere between total sobriety and total transparency. Now, I don't know if there is a word that combines those two qualities, sobriety and transparency, but that is the wisdom elixir that arises from the transmutation of guilt. So this is the five skull crown initiation in a preview. And as I said, it is actually an initiation that belongs technically or formally to the realm of Kala Tantra, which is, as it were, a module of planetary tantra. And yet, this instruction of Kala Tantra, of a more advanced stage of planetary tantra, if you will, beyond the general access stage, is available to everyone in the general access experience through the instruction of Mama Teach. So I'm going to conclude there because I'm at an hour and 20 minutes in this rather rambling and disjointed briefing, and pick it up soon. I don't know where, I don't know when. This is day 28 of the Vajrayogini shift. It's 6:30 in the morning. I'm on the vigil with the sunrise crescent, as I have been for the last four evenings. And I will return to that vigil now, conclude this briefing, and get back to you on the next occasion when my powers and my concentration allow me to do so.